good. I'm just going to set that right there.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we're good.
Nope. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know whose water that is then.
If you want me to, I'll just go holler
okay.
for people to come inside, and then if you want to get us.
All right, so the people that come in late get the quiz, right? Those who are here don't get the quiz, right? That's how we do it. Meanwhile, I'm looking at my clock that I have on my computer, and it's still sent for Eastern time. So I looked at it earlier, and that's why I took the phone out, because I was like, wait, we're way off time. First time I ever preached, I had a friend of mine, he allowed me to preach. And it was a Wednesday night, and I preached. And to this day, I don't know how long I actually preached. All I know is some of us will remember what cassette tapes are. I flipped a 92-minute cassette tape. So we did both sides and then some. So yeah, I learned how to tell time after that. All right, so while we're waiting for some of the folks to come in, I was asked by someone, I'm trying to look to see if he's here, how I came to Christ, being Jewish. So, it was you, right? Okay. So, I want to make sure you're here. I'll give the answer while we wait for them to come in. But I got saved 16 years old. My parents sent me away. My mother had died when I was 9, 10 years old. And my parents, I got kicked out of every summer camp that they put me in. I was just a real problem. And my mother's death did not make it any better. I didn't know how to deal with things. And so what ended up happening was the bus driver on this trip, we drove around the summer to go into different places. The bus driver was a Christian. All Jewish kids on the trip, and his mission was to evangelize all the Jewish kids. I basically said to him, you know, he started sharing the gospel over a fortune cookie. So you can transition from anything to the gospel. We'll talk about that later in this session. And he basically, I literally told him, I said, Chuck, that's good for you, but I'm God's chosen people. I'm in like Flynn. I thought my Judaism saved me. That's what I was raised to believe. And he turned to me, and I say this to say, people sometimes say, I'm afraid I'm going to say something stupid when evangelizing. Chuck said something really stupid that all of the adults had been warned before I went, that I literally, if someone made a mother joke or made any reference to my mother at that age, I would actually black out. To this day, I can't tell you what I actually did, but there were enough stories and people that would witness. I remember one summer camp, I supposedly took the biggest kid in the bunk. So I still find this hard to believe because I was like the scrawny little kid. He made a mother joke, and I chased him, and I supposedly picked him up, and I threw him in a garbage bag. One of these big 55-gallon garbage cans, and kicked it down a hill. And I'm like, there's no way I did that to him. He's way too strong. But five adults told me I did that, and I have no recollection of it. So they were warned not to say, like, that I would snap, and I have no record. Like, I wouldn't know what I'm doing. And so Chuck says, son, really stupid. It's not theologically accurate. Knowing the issue with my mom, it's not a smart thing to say, but as I'm walking away from him, he goes, what if your mother died? So you'd be right here, right now, listening to this message, and you walk away, your mother would have died in vain. Like, think about that one and be like, that's awful offensive. And I remember I had my back to him, I clenched my fists, and for some reason, I remember releasing him, I turned around, I said, Chuck, you give me a good reason to believe, and I'll believe. And here, I told you that, you know, I have my IQ, I have passed the test for Mensa. At that point in my life, I was very arrogant about my intellect. Chuck never finished the sixth grade. And I always say, people say, it's got to have a sense of humor. Yes. He takes a kid who thinks he's the smartest guy in the world and takes someone who he would never have any respect for because he didn't finish the sixth grade and goes, this is the guy that's going to teach you the most important thing you ever need to learn. And so Chuck went through the Bible knowing prophecy. And what he didn't realize is in my head I was running calculations of all these prophecies and saying this could be coincidence and this could be self-fulfilling. So if it's self-fulfilling, I don't count it. And I stopped him at one point. I said, Chuck, we are beyond statistical impossibility, which is 10 to the 48th power. of these prophecies happening by chance. He's like, what do you mean? I said, it means that the New Testament had to have been written by God. So what does it say? So I actually believed the New Testament before believing about Jesus. And so he talked about Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. And I tried every argument against the resurrection. Anyone read More Than a Carpenter by Josh McDowell or Evidence of Man's Vert? So you know all the false arguments for the resurrection? I had them all without reading his book. I have one that I think to date is still original with me. My last argument is, Chuck, maybe the disciples, they dug a hole underneath the tomb and they snuck the body out from underneath. That's how the guards didn't know. Chuck looks at me and goes, in 3 days? Andrew, they didn't have heavy equipment back then. I mean, going into rock. And I stuck my head in my hands on the steps of a Dairy Queen, shook my head. He goes, what's wrong? I said, well, if Jesus Christ is God, then I'm accountable to him. And Chuck's like, that's what I've been trying to tell you. And so I went in 3.5 hours from believing that Jesus Christ is Hitler's God to being a follower of Christ. Now, I thought that's how everyone does it. I didn't realize everybody usually hears the gospel over and over and over again. I just thought, oh, you just explain it once and everyone gets it. No, I was wrong. So, yeah. So I usually say what brought me to Christ is mathematics. Because that usually gets people to go, what? How did mathematics do it? So it's prophecy was where it started. So, yeah. All right. So, for those who came in late, you have a quiz. Okay. What's the first principle that we want to have to do? What was the first principle we talked about? Well, no, but that's the idea of it is to what? Disarm their defenses. How are we going to disarm their defenses? What were the two things that we disarmed? Humor? No, the question's not questions. What? Be polite. So disarm their defenses by using humor and being polite. Who else? What's the second principle? Who else can be defensive? Okay, so we disarm our defenses. How? Now's the time to asking good questions, right? Okay. So now we want to talk about avoiding being judgmental. How do we avoid being judgmental? Okay. And this is where we're going to talk about the law. This is where anyone that's familiar with that little kiwi, the guy, Ray, what's it? Comfort. Yeah, he's very comfortable. Yeah. By the way, he is, if you ever get to meet Ray, he's a consummate jokester, okay? Like, all the time. But it's always a fun conversation with him. So, before we get to this, I want to talk about some problems we have with the modern gospel. The way that many people talk about the gospel is from a gospel tract, God has a wonderful plan for your life, right? It was four spiritual laws. Anyone remember that gospel tract? The person who wrote that gospel tract now calls it the four spiritual flaws. Because they realize that there's some problems in it. Because what is the wonderful plan that God has for your life if you're going to hell? Right? I mean, if you think about it, if you're headed to hell, then this is your best life now. Oops. Anyone that reads Joel Osteen? Joel writes a book, Your Best Life Now. Well, that's only for people going to hell. This is, for the Christian, this is the worst life now. This is as bad as life gets. And then we got eternity of our best life, right? God, what's the wonderful plan? Like, the idea that people have is this idea that, you know, you're so important that God needed you, right? God has a plan for you. And he does have a plan, and sometimes that plan is destruction. He says that in Romans chapter 9, right? What was the plan for Pharaoh? It was destruction, right? So there's a problem when we communicate a gospel that lifts up man. Because you know why it's a problem? Because man already lifts himself up. One of the questions I ask people when we start the gospel, when we talk to good person tests, is, you know, are you good enough to go to heaven? 90% of the people say they're good enough. 2% are honest and say no. That other 8% say they're awesome. I had a guy I was witnessing to in the mall. I asked him, you know, do you think you're good enough to go to heaven? I said, you think you're a good person? He goes, I'm an awesome person. Okay. Have you ever stolen anything? Yes. Does it make you a thief? Have you ever lied? Yes. Does it make you a liar? And I usually will ask, have you ever murdered anyone? Because people will say no, and I'll say that God's standard is so high that he judges our anger as murder of the heart. Have you ever been angry with someone? But so I said to this guy, I said, have you ever murdered anyone? He said, yes. Maybe he doesn't understand the difference between murder and killing. And so I said, you know, are you a police officer or in military? And he goes, they weren't legal killings. Killings? Let me take a step back. And now, I admit, I got a little bit nervous with that. I wanted to disarm, right? So what did I do? I turned and said, hey, can we go back to that first question I asked you? When you said, I asked you if you consider yourself to be a good person, what did you say? He goes, yeah, well, I said I was awesome, but maybe I'm not. I'm like, yeah, I'm thinking not, but I don't want to say that. Someone tells me I don't want to get you upset. So the thing is, people think highly of themselves. And when we present a gospel message that lifts man up, you know what that does? Lowers God. See, when you lift up man's effort, you lower what Jesus did on the cross. And so we've got to be careful with that. So saying that God has a wonderful plan for your life, what that does is that gets people to say, well, hey, I just want God, I want to believe in God to fix something in my life. I want to heal this. I lost my job, I got divorced, I lost a spouse, and I want a fix. And I got news for you. What ends up happening is those people, they come to Jesus to fix something for self-help, and then they go to church and all of a sudden their life falls apart. Why? Because now all of a sudden the rest of the world's system is against them. Right? Because, like, demons can't tell if you're actually a Christian. They just see that you're acting like one. So, okay, let's go after this person. And then things go, you know, fall apart. And people go, oh, I tried Jesus and it didn't work. Yeah, we don't try Jesus is the thing. Here's another one. God loves you. I refer to this as the false gospel of God loves you. You know what they mean by that? When people say that God loves you, they mean God should treat you like a spoiled brat, right? God should give you everything you want. That's what it is. And people think this way. I remember in Union Square in New York City, I was talking to this gentleman, and we were walking in the park, and I started a conversation. And, you know, I start talking about him, what he does for a living, and learn a little about him. He was vice president of his company, pretty good-sized company, several, you know, I think he said thousands of employees, I think, if I remember correctly, but you know, he was high up. And so I start talking. I asked him if he thinks he's good enough to go to heaven. He says, God doesn't exist. I said, would you consider yourself to be an atheist? He said, yes. I said, can you give me your best argument for atheism? So that's usually my question. Give me your best argument for atheism. You know what their best argument for atheism is? Christianity's wrong. You notice that's not actually an argument for atheism. It's an argument against Christianity. And I said, well, I didn't ask you what's wrong with Christianity. I asked you for your best argument for atheism. He said, when I was a child, I prayed and God wouldn't answer my prayer. I said, what do you pray for? He said, well, I have a learning disability. And it was hard for me in school. And I prayed that God would let me be like every other student and I could not have this learning disability. And he wouldn't do that. I said, really? So you have a learning disability. Did that mean you had to work harder in school? He said, yeah, I had to work twice as hard as any other kid. So while all the other kids were out playing, I had to study. I said, you had to study. Did that make you work harder? He said, yeah. I said, when you got out of school and you got a job, did it affect you? He says, yeah, I had to work harder than all my colleagues. They could go home. I had to keep working to make sure I learned things. I said, did you by any chance get rewarded for working hard at your job? He goes, well, yeah. I said, well, let me ask you a question. If God answered your prayer when you were 8 years old, would you be vice president of your company right now? And literally, we were walking, and he just stopped, and I took a couple steps and realized, oh, he's back there. And he goes, I never thought of that. Total change of perspective. Why? Because he thought he was God. And God should love him so much to give him everything he wants. That's the way a lot of people present the gospel. You know why they do that? You see, they water down the gospel. And people don't water down the gospel because they care about souls. People water down the gospel because they want to be liked. And quite frankly, we have to get over ourselves. So I talked a little bit there about the life enhancement. Come to Jesus, he's going to fix your problems. No, you come to Jesus, you're going to have more problems. Easy believism. Just believe. Just say a prayer. Just walk this aisle, say this prayer, you're good. I still remember going door to door with one of the other elders in my church. 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning, we come to this guy's house. He's drunk. 10 o'clock in the morning. We figured he was probably still drinking from the night before. But we get into a conversation, and my buddy John just says, tries sharing the gospel to him, and the guy goes, "I'm a Christian." And John goes, "I don't mean to be offensive, sir, but I mean, it is 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning and you're completely drunk. I find it hard to believe that you'd be a Christian just from your behavior." And he goes, "I'll prove it." He goes in his house, comes out, takes his wallet, pulls out a card. "I signed it. I said the prayer. I'm going to heaven. I was told if I ever doubt, just look at this card." That's a horrible thing. The guy's not looking to get saved, right? Free grace. Free grace is just, hey, you can live any way you want. You have the people nowadays that they're like, hey, we're open, we're an inclusive church. Grace of Jesus, you can live any way you want. What they want is fire insurance. They want to get out of hell free card. I actually have a tract that I used to carry called the Get Out of Hell Free Card. I'd give that to people. We'll talk about tracts. I have a picture of it. What this produces is false converts. It produces people that don't know the true gospel, are not going to heaven because they're not in Christ, but even worse, they're not looking for salvation because they're confident in their false gospel. That's the hardest thing. John 1, 12 and 13 says this, but to all who did receive him, who believe in his name, he gave the right to be a child of God. Now first, let's just stop there. Right? You have Mormons and many others that say, we're all children of God. That's not what that verse says. Only those who believe in him have the right to be a child of God. But how? Next verse, verse 13. Who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. So what's he saying? It's not by the blood. So your genealogy won't save you. In my case, my Judaism won't save me. It's not by the will of the flesh, the hard work. You just work your way, do good works, you're going to get there. It's not by the will of man. Not just your desire, just like, oh, I want to go to heaven. It's not those, but of God. You see, what those other gospels produce, it's not of God, it's of our own desire. Our desire to be in heaven. You know, how many people have read Pilgrim's Progress? Okay, anyone not read Pilgrim's Progress? Okay, you should read it. Great book. No, I'm serious. It really is. So, but I'm going to give you the ending of it. So I'm going to spoil the ending for you. Don't blame me. You'll still enjoy it. No, but here's the thing. In Pilgrim's Progress, we meet an individual called Ignorance. Remember Ignorance? Ignorance comes on the path. He doesn't have the Bible, what refers to as the Bible there. He doesn't have the words of God. He just is on the path to heaven. But he doesn't want to go through the proper road, the trials of life, and have to do. So he goes on an easy path. And at the end of the story, he gets to heaven too, doesn't he? And he discovers that in heaven, there's a gateway right to hell, right? because he was going the whole way ignorant of the fact that he needed to follow God's plan, not his own plan. He had a way he thought was good, but that way led to destruction. So this is what the law does for us. This is the purpose of the law. Because one of the things you're going to be challenged with when you start sharing the gospel, someone's going to say that you're judging them. Well, I want to avoid being called judgmental. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to use God's law, and I'm going to let it do the work that it does. It's going to define what sin is. Now, you know, I discovered, now if any of you grew up in the church, you may not even have recognized this, but when I became a Christian, I realized that all of you Christians talk funny. You have your own Christianese. You have this language you speak, and it may be biblical language, but you know, people don't always understand it. Like I had a friend of mine, we were going door to door, and we knocked on the door, and lady opens the door, and he says, "Hi, we're from Emmanuel Bible Church, and I just want to share with you the message of Jesus Christ that you have to be washed in the blood of Jesus." Boom, that door was slammed. And I looked at him like, "Bernie, what are you saying?" He goes, "What? It's biblical language." "What is she thinking, being washed in blood? She thinks you're some cult." I'm like, "Don't you think you could use language that she's not going to flip out at?" He's like, "But it's biblical. That's what we should do." Right? We speak a Christianese. That's okay. Jewish people, we do the same thing. Every group does it. Right? We have our own kind of language that we get used to. But you know what? When we speak to someone that isn't in our circles, we have to remember not to use that language. You know, if I say someone's a sinner, what is sin? And we really think about it. What is it? Like, people use that word, but they just mean you do bad things. But what sin really is? Well, really what it is, it's breaking God's law, right? It's being a criminal. Well, how can I communicate that? I use the law. How do I know that someone is a rapist? If they've raped. How many times, by the way, did you have to rape to be a rapist? One. How many times do you have to murder someone to be a murderer? One. How many times do you have to lie to be a liar? One. It's amazing how many people go, "Oh, but I'm not a liar." Yeah, too bad, you already admitted to lying once. And if you say you're not a liar, I think you lied. Right? But the idea of it is that when we use the law, what we're doing with a person is helping them see what sin actually is and making it personal, right? It focuses on the proper object, God, and not self. You see, the false gospel messages, what do they focus on? The person. What the law does is turn that focus to God. You see? It's a totally different way of approaching the gospel. We lift God up on high and recognize that we human beings are nothing. And so that's the purpose of the gospel, of the law. So we have the Ten Commandments. We'll get to those in a bit. So the purpose of the law. The law solves the problem of the modern gospel. Okay? Because the method of the gospel, of the modern gospel message, what they do is put the solution before the problem. Come to Jesus. Why? I mean, they haven't explained what the problem is. You see, I say this all the time. It is not hard to get somebody saved. It's very hard to get them lost. They already think they're saved. They already think they're a good person. It's getting them to recognize they're not that's difficult. Because once someone sees that they have an understanding that they have broken God's law and deserve eternity in a lake of fire, they're going to want to cry out and say, "What do I got to do to be saved?" Just like the Philippian jailer. But you see, most people don't want to think that that punishment is really not going to be for me. And so we have to get them lost. And that's what the law ends up doing. We have to remember something when it comes to the modern gospel message. What you win someone with, you keep them with. So if you win them with a message about selfishness, you only keep them with selfishness. And that's why we see a selfish church nowadays. We see a church that is about self. Now, I'm going to say this before being here on a Sunday, so I may get myself in trouble because I don't know what songs you sing. But I travel around the world. I see many churches. When I was pastoring, I used to do this thing with the guy that would lead songs. Every once in a while, he did a really bad thing, and he would pick a song without running it by me. And I would do this. they'd be singing a song, and as he's singing, I'd do this. I'd point up, I'd point to myself. I'd point up, and I'd point to myself. He knew what that meant. Is this song about God, or is it about me? You know, 90% of the messages of the songs being written today for churches is about me. It's self. When it does talk about God, you know what it's doing? It's talking about what God did for me. It's not lifting God up on high. Why do they do that? Because they came in with a gospel of self, and they keep them with a gospel of self. And then they wonder why the church is so anemic to the world around us. Because the church is now looking like the world. It's all about self. So we see that what the law does is it accuses the sinner. In John 5, verse 45, do not think that I will not accuse you to the Father. There is one who accuses you, Moses, on whom you have set your hope. What does he mean by that? Well, Moses would be this book, the law. When we speak of the Old Testament, the way that you speak of it in Hebrew, the Hebrew word for the Old Testament, the Bible, would be Tanakh. The Tanakh is made up of the first letters of three different words. Torah for law. Then you have the prophets and the writings. What are those? Sometimes you hear the law and the prophets. Well, that's what it is. God's word is referred to. So when he says of Moses, he's speaking of the law. Okay? The Bible. That's what we have. That's the purpose of the Bible, is to accuse us. See, but we don't want to accuse people, because they might not like us. We're probably not ever going to see them again anyway. Oops, no, wait, you will on Judgment Day. We're all going to see the people we share the gospel with on Judgment Day. One way or another, I always end the gospel conversations I have with people. I'll end it when I'm doing open air. I say, you know, we'll see each other one day. And when we see each other, we're going to remember this conversation. You're either going to see me in Judgment Day and say, I thank you for sharing the gospel with me because I understood and believed. Or you're going to see me and say, and you're going to know you're without excuse because the gospel was shared with you. Right? But that's what it does. The law is a schoolmaster, according to Galatians 3. All right? The law leads to repentance of sin. See, this is the difference. The modern gospel message, it's usually about life enhancement. It's about me getting something from God. You know, God had this human-shaped hole in his heart, and he just needed us to fill it. Like, wouldn't it be nice if God just had fellowship with us because we're so special? And the reality is that what that does is lift people up. And yet the gospel we see in Romans 7 is the gospel will lead to repentance because we recognize what sin is and how wicked we actually are. Now, one of the things when I share the gospel is I will always, to the person I'm speaking to, I know that they are going to think, because this is what our culture teaches, that you Christians think you're holier than us. You put yourselves above us. You know, I'm usually preaching on a box, so I'm up here, okay? And they're like, see, you're trying to put yourself. So I used to have a box for them, but but then when a guy fell off the box, I was afraid I'd be sued. So, you know, but what I do is I always say, this is what I end up saying. I always say this, I'll grant you that you're probably a far more moral person than me. Now, what am I doing? I'm addressing the sin issue, but I'm not putting myself above him. I'm putting him above me. I'll say, I'll grant that to you. I'll give it to you. You're probably a far more moral person than me, but our morality doesn't get us into heaven. Right? So I always, when I go through the law, I'm always going to say, I'll say, I got a quiz for you, and I'm going to let you know up front, I've failed all 10 questions. So don't worry if you don't do bad. You can't do worse than me. I failed every question. Right? What am I always trying? I want to lift up. You see the sense of respect that we talked about in the last session, right? That's what we want to build. We're ambassadors. The law humbles the proud. This is what James ends up saying in James 4, right? So we give the law to the proud and the gospel to the humble. I had a friend of mine, Chad Williams, who used to work with Ray over at Living Waters. He's got a book out called Seal of God. He was a Navy SEAL, big, tough-looking guy, you know. And I remember once we were at Huntington Beach, he and I, we were evangelizing, and he did something I'd never seen him do before. And he's sitting on the box, and some guy was just being so arrogant with him. I mean, just really, really arrogant. And Chad just sat there, looks at the guy, goes, "No gospel for you today. I was going to give you the gospel, but no gospel for you today. You're not getting it." And I'm like sitting there like, and the guy walked away. And I'm sitting there, I'm talking to Chad. I'm like, "Chad, what was with that?" He goes, "I don't know." He goes, "I don't know why I did that. I felt like that guy, like giving him the gospel was throwing pearls before swine." He goes, he was so arrogant. I just felt like I shouldn't share the gospel with him. And literally, as he's saying that, the same guy walks up. And he turns to Chad and goes, "Why can't I have the gospel?" And Chad goes, "Now you can." And we walked over, you know, his parents used to live just walking distance from Honey Beach. So we're walking to his dad's house. As we're walking there, Chad's just going, "Isn't it amazing? The law for the proud, grace to the humble." He said, "That guy, you know, he's like, you know, Ray teaches that all the time." He goes, "And here this guy was being so proud, I gave him the law and stopped there, and he came back with grace." And it was like he was so receptive to the gospel when Chad shared it with him, you know? So why use the law? Well, it avoids you being called judgmental. I mean, that's the one thing you can't do nowadays, right? You can't judge other people. By the way, did you ever think about this? If I tell you that you're judging people, you ever notice that that's a judgment? Thank you. That's a judgment. So when people say, "You shouldn't judge me," but you know, or they'll say, like, you can't judge people. Well, you can. Why do you get to do it? In fact, what I used to do in the streets is people say, "Judging others is wrong." And I go, "I don't think so. I'm married." And I sit silently till everyone's thoroughly confused like you guys are. And then I go, "Well, I judge there were a bunch of women not appropriate for me to marry and one that was." We make judgment calls all the time. Every time you see a yellow traffic light, you make a judgment call. Can I make it? Speed up, right? Slow down. I forget, there was a TV show with an alien. I remember this as a kid. You know, the alien in the human body, he watches the woman drive, and he goes through a yellow light really, really fast. And she goes, "I thought you said you know how to drive." He goes, "Yeah, I watched you." Green, go. Red, stop. Yellow, go very fast. We make judgment calls all the time, okay? We're going to get to whether we should judge or not. But we want to take that argument away from them. So you know what the law does? When people sit there and say that I'm judging, I can always appeal to, "I'm sorry, I didn't judge anybody. I just let you judge yourself. I just gave you the standard of judgment, and I let you judge yourself. I didn't judge you. I asked you if you were a liar. I didn't call you a liar. When I'd say, 'Have you ever lied?' They say, 'Yes.' I said, 'What does that make you?' I don't call them a liar. And if they can't call themselves a liar, I'll say, 'Well, if I lied to you, what would you call me?' They go, 'Liar.'" It's amazing. They say it so quickly when they're calling you a liar, but they can't call themselves one, right? And so it's amazing because they have no problem judging me, right? This avoids the Christian language, that Christianese that we speak. It avoids the intellect. If you're worried that you're not smart enough to handle a PhD, you know, this avoids it. Now, sometimes you can have fun with guys that are PhDs. We would go to Washington Square, which is right outside of New York University, and we'd get real intellectuals. I've debated biology professors on evolution. I've debated a lot of, you know, and then I go to Union Square 10 blocks down, and I get, like, all the wackadoos. It's like night and day, but I remember I had a PhD candidate, a physicist, and he's trying to explain to me that, you know, I just don't understand the way the universe was created. Because Stephen Hawking explained to us that there was nothing in the beginning. And I said, "Well, if there was nothing, then you're saying nothing became everything." He goes, "No, you don't understand. Stephen Hawking explained to us that nothing was something." Now, you need to have a PhD for this to make sense, I guess, because, and so what I did, right, I want to use humor, And I recognize that I have a crowd of about, you know, like 100, 150 people that are listening. So I went on this, like, literally like a 10-minute rant, just going, well, you know, I'm not as smart as you, Simon. But, you know, to me, nothing is nothing and something is something. Nothing's not something and something's not nothing. If nothing is something, then something's not nothing and nothing is something. I don't understand, because nothing should be nothing and something should be something. Which is it? Is it nothing or is it something? Because if there's nothing, then that's not something. If there's something, then it's not nothing. So is it something or is it nothing? I don't, can't understand. You're really confusing me, because I don't have a PhD to understand that nothing's actually something. and he just sat there. Everybody was laughing, right? Because it showed the ridiculousness of saying that something's actually nothing, but that nothing's actually something. It was either nothing or something. My definition of nothing: nothing is what rocks dream about. So what we end up seeing, though, is you can get into these things where you have PhD guys, they're really smart. I do a show, Apologetics Live. It's Thursday. It's live Thursday nights for you guys. It's 5 to 7 for your time, okay? You just go to apologeticslive.com. I can answer any question you have about God in the Bible. And I can. I think I don't know is a perfectly good answer. You ask me a tough question, I'm going to say I don't know. That's an answer. So, but I get people all the time. We had a guy on who is a PhD biologist. And he wrote a book about the genome. Well, we had this guy from Rutgers, a PhD professor at Rutgers, that teaches at the PhD level, come in. Well, those two start talking. I just took myself out of the conversation. I'm like, you two go for it, because I'm not even understanding what you're talking about. But at the end, I said, look, Professor, I got a question for you. I know that we have a judge that tells us, you know, judges can't answer this question, only biologists can. So you're a biologist. Can you tell me, what is a woman? He was like, oh, we don't have enough time to answer that. That's a real long question. I said, no, it isn't. A woman is what God, the creator of women, defines it as. That's what a woman is. So, yeah, I mean, you can get into these intellectual debates. Going to the law avoids all that, though. Because now it's just, have you broken God's law? Have you lied? Have you stolen? Have you coveted? Have you murdered even in your heart? Have you lusted? Because that would be adultery of the heart, right? It speaks to the conscience and avoids the intellect, okay? Because it gets back to this. It defines and explains what sin is without using Christian language. But it also personalizes sin. If you use the law effectively, you're asking the person, have you done this? Because what I do is I'll ask people, have you ever told a lie? They say yes. And I'll say, what does that make you? Number one answer, human. Number two answer, sinner. And when I say, if I lied to you, what would you call me? Liar. I mean, they do it so quick, right? But so what it does is it personalizes sin so they realize they are a sinner. And it provides a standard of righteousness. See, you talk about sin and people are always going to leave. No, I'm just kidding. They told me they were going to leave earlier. They had to be somewhere, but I thought I was going to give them a hard time. We'll see. All right. So let's talk about the Ten Commandments. It helps, what the Ten Commandments do is it helps people see that they are lawbreakers. See, this is a hard thing. Because what do people do? Well, I'm not so bad. I mean, I'm better than Hitler or Stalin or name the person that you think is worse than you. But guess what? That's not the standard. Who's the standard? God. Oops. I had an Orthodox Jewish guy that wanted to debate me on the fact that he wanted to prove that the New Testament couldn't be written by God. He came on to Apologetics Live, and we did like 4.5 hours straight of debate. And this was after several long emails going back and forth. And we had many afterwards as well. And I made one thing that just shocked him, because I basically compared him to Hitler. And for a Jewish person, Orthodox Jewish person, that was like anathema, right? But I said, listen, you and I and Hitler decide we're going to swim from New York, because he's from Brooklyn. I said, we're going to swim from New York over to the UK. I'm a really bad swimmer. I only go half a mile and I drowned. Hitler goes a mile, he drowns. You're a good swimmer. Ben Zion, you go, you know, 2 miles and you drowned. But you compare that distance, even though you went further than Hitler, you went twice as far as Hitler. Comparing that with the distance to the UK, can't even tell the difference. Negligible, right? You're no better than Hitler. He did not like that. But it's what he probably needed to hear, because what's his problem? He doesn't think he's going to hell because he's Jewish. He thinks his Judaism saves. We're God's chosen people, right? So, but the reality is that that's what the law is going to do. It's going to help us to recognize that we break God's law. Let me ask you, what is it that brings the consequence? Is it the act itself, or is it sometimes who we offend? If you threaten my life, I'm sure Pastor Jason would never do this. He would never threaten my life. He just threatened to convert me to Amil. No. But no, if you threaten my life, what are the police going to do? Tell you to stay away? Right? If you threaten Joe Biden's life, prior to this past week, I would have said you'd go to jail for 48 hours, right? Now they just kill you if you haven't filed that in Utah, right? What was the difference? The person who was offended, right? President has that position, carries some weight to it. Well, God is even higher than the president. Don't let Joe Biden knows that. He thinks he's the end-all be-all. All right, but the use of the law helps convict someone, right? It gets to their conscience, avoids all the argument. It helps them to understand that they've broken God's law, and because that law was broken to an infinite God, guess what? It has an infinite consequence. This is what I had shared with the Jehovah's Witness that came by my house once, is the fact is that if you believe God is infinite, then he's infinitely just, right? And he said, yeah. I said, so if you break his law, doesn't there have to be an infinite consequence for that? So if there is no hell, then God really isn't infinitely just. There's a limit to his justice. It ends. And so we end up seeing that there's some noise being made. So how to use the law. So this is what we call the good person test. I don't know if it's my thing or.
I think Jason put some holy water on it before. I think it's switched out with his.
Amil water.
It was. I was gonna say it was all because of the joke about Amil, wasn't it? Okay. I'm just gonna unplug this here. Try plugging it back in. See if that.
For those who watch the new Wizard of Oz.
I don't know which one. Is this the one on the TV or is this the DVD?
He changed his chair.
Oh, you changed his
chair. It still has to change.
Is it done?
If you want to go ahead and draw, I'll see if I can.
Okay. You do that. There we go.
Yeah, well, that's what I did. That's where it lost the signal. But I could try it again.
Or maybe it came loose back here.
So it should be on. Let's see, H. It should, looks like it should be my 1 or 2.
Okay, so what we want to do is talk about what Ray Comfort calls the good person test, right? The reason he calls it the good person test is because the first question is, are you a good person? Because that's where we want to help them to see, is that are they a good enough person to go to heaven? Okay? So before we do, some of the things I want you to see is that when we talk about this, this is an outline. It's not a routine. It's not a program. I don't want you looking at your fingers like the woman I said with faith, right? Where it's like, yeah, I got to do this. It's a conversation. Let it flow. But what it is an outline, so you know that wherever the conversation goes, you can come back to your outline, okay? So it's not something that's a memorized speech, although there's things I say that I use over and over and over and over again because I say it so often, because I share the gospel so often, okay? You have to remember that the person doesn't know where you're going in the conversation. You know where you're going because you know the outline of it. So as we share this, it's something where we just got to realize that it's something that you couldn't get it? Okay. That's too bad. It's something that you want to just go with wherever the person takes the conversation. Okay? So, the way we start this is the first question you ask is, are you a good person or are you good enough to go to heaven? Okay? Now, there's things you could do. You know, you guys, how many of you guys love those spam callers? Okay, I love them. You know what that is? You know why they're calling you? So you can practice sharing the gospel. You don't even have to worry about the rejection. You know, you realize that when they reject you, you're getting exactly what you want. Click. No, okay, I've learned I shouldn't say, are you a good person to them? Because they already know they're planning to scam you. Because when you say, are you a good person, click, they don't get past that. So I say, hey, I got a question for you first. Do you think you're good enough to go to heaven? And I had a guy go, well, I'm calling you about these windows. I said, yeah, I get it, but you're on my time right now. So let me share what I want to share with you, and then you can share what you want. Is that okay? And some will say, no, click, which, guess what? I wanted that click anyway. And if they say yes, okay, well, sometimes I have to listen to them share about their windows, okay? But it gives me a chance to practice sharing the gospel. And I say, are you good enough? I have a question for you. Are you good enough to go to heaven? Right? So I usually start with that. Why? Because we want them to see what goodness is, because they think they're good. And so the thing becomes, how would you like to take a good person test? You can ask that. Now, if I do that IQ test that we had up earlier, what I do is this. I put the IQ test up, and I go, look, hey, I put this up because I could fool you so easily on something so simple. Can I fool you on something that's more important? I said, let me see if I could test you on something important. Do you think you're a good person? Now, I just said I'm going to fool them, and what do they always say? Yes, they are. And I go, can I test that now? And I just go into the good person test, okay? And unfortunately, I can't play the video that I had for you. But what I do is I go through the Ten Commandments. You shouldn't have any gods other than God. Don't take the Lord's name in vain. You shouldn't have any images of God or make an idol. Keeping the Sabbath, which I'm going to argue is different than the way some Presbyterians would have it. I would have a different view of keeping the Sabbath for Christians. Do not murder, don't commit adultery, do not steal, do not lie, do not covet. Okay? By the way, when you look at the Ten Commandments, there is a different counting of the Ten Commandments between Judaism, Catholicism, and Christianity. Anyone want to take a guess which one the Catholics don't include? Idols. Because what do they have? A bunch of idols. So they take the coveting, and it's don't covet your neighbor's property and don't covet your neighbor's wife. So they get to 10. Yeah. So what we're doing, though, is you go through and you can ask the person. And we're going to do this in a little bit. Okay, we're going to do some role play. And you guys are going to actually do this with each other. What you're going to want to do is ask, do you consider yourself to be a good person? The person's going to say yes. Have you ever told a lie? Yes. What does that make you? A liar. Have you ever stolen anything? What does that make you? A stealer? That's what they say. Have you ever murdered anybody? No. Have you ever been angry with someone? Well, yeah. Well, that God judges anger as murder of the heart. Considers adultery as lust. That's adultery of the heart. Right? Because God is so great that the things that go in our mind, he judges that as well. Not just our actions, but our thoughts. And so when we get through the law, we can explain to them by that standard. Now notice, we're not judging, are we? We've just provided the standard. By that standard, would you be innocent or guilty? What are we asking with that? We're saying, well, you've already identified yourself as guilty. Now we just want you to admit it. Would you be innocent or guilty? And it's amazing how many times they say guilty. And then the follow-up question I'll ask is, I say, look, I know we all desire heaven, but if we're guilty, notice I'm saying we, I'm always including myself in that. If we're both guilty, would we deserve heaven or hell? I've already acknowledged that we want heaven, but which do we deserve? We just said we're guilty, right? And it's amazing how many people go, heaven. I didn't ask which one we want. Which do we deserve? And because you want them to realize they deserve hell. And then when they say that, when they acknowledge that they deserve hell, you can ask the question, does that concern you? Does it concern you that you could be one of the 180,000 people that will enter into eternity today and you'd spend eternity in a lake of fire? Does that concern you? If they say no, they're either being dishonest, you have a question, or you just raise your hand. If they say no, then, it's like you're probably wasting your time with them, right? But if they say yes, I remember once in the mall, I was talking to this one lady. She was all kinds of joking around and not taking it serious. And yeah, I've lied, so what? Not a big deal. And I got to this point and I said, does it concern you that if you died today, you could spend eternity in a lake of fire? And she went, yeah, you know what? I think you ruined my weekend. I said, I ruined your weekend. She goes, I was just coming to the mall to pick something up and I was planning on going out and getting drunk. Well, she used a different word, getting drunk with my friends. I don't think I can do that now, right? This is where these last two questions where I see people, where I see whether they're really understanding what the gospel is, that they truly deserve to spend eternity in a lake of fire, and it should concern them. Okay, now if it doesn't concern them, I go back to the law, because they obviously don't see themselves as a sinner. Okay, I don't try to convince them. I don't sit there and go, let me just try to convince you one more time that you're such a good person. And then the last question I ask is, do you know what God did? And this is where I can share what the gospel is, right? That we've all sinned. Romans 5:12, Romans 3:9-10. We've all sinned. That the wages of sin is death. Psalm 7:11, Romans 6:23. That we can't save ourselves. Ephesians 2:8-9, Titus 3:5. And that we need a Savior. That Savior is Jesus Christ. That they have to repent. It means a change of our thinking. What we're changing is stop trusting self and trusting God. We don't trust our good works or our good nature, right? That's why we start with, are you a good person? We don't trust our good nature or our good works. We trust God. We repent and believe. That's what the gospel message is. And this is what we look to do. So, let's see. Can't play the video because we don't have the video. All right, there we go. So what I'm doing with all this is to say this is how you avoid being called judgmental. You're still going to be called judgmental. But I said I'd answer the question, what do we say about that? Judge not, right? You shouldn't judge. It's the one passage of the Bible that every unbeliever seems to know. Judge not! They really should keep reading, because he is saying judge not. He's saying to judge not by an outward judgment, by appearances. He's saying that you're not to have a wrong standard, because the standard you judge others, you're going to be judged by. Does the Bible say that we shouldn't judge? Well, actually, in John 7:24, for those red letter Bible people that just think that the red letters are all that count, Jesus himself not just said, but commanded to judge. He said, do not judge from outward appearance, but judge by a righteous judgment, a righteous standard, the word of God. It's an imperative in the Greek. Jesus himself actually commanded people to judge. So, if people want to say you shouldn't judge, Jesus disagrees with you. Sorry. All right, so let's put some of this together. So, as we look at it, we want to talk about how to start conversations. So we talked about being an ambassador, being a representative of Jesus, right? We talked about the fact of we want to disarm their defenses by using humor and being polite, disarm our defenses by asking good questions. We talked about avoid being judgmental by using the law that helps us to communicate to them what the gospel message is. But how do we start the conversations? Well, one thing that we can do, an easy thing to do, is gospel tracts. Okay? I have a thing. Hey, Yim, do you have the control card? Either that or think about it.
Which one do you have?
You got a controller? Okay. None of you saw that.
Okay. So this is what I do. I'm going to show you the trick. Where's the gospel tract? It's right here. But they never see it. Usually I love doing this. Like I'm at a restaurant, I'm going to get the bill. The waiter or waitress, and I have my phone open like this and it's on. And I say, hey, hold on a second. I keep it at the edge of the table like this. And then I pick it up, putting my finger right there. And I'll say, hey, I just want to print something for you. And I push this magical little button. I like the noise, and I usually let it, I'll say, hey, let's just give it a second to dry, and then what I do is, there it is. Did you get one of these? That's for you. Do you know, nobody refuses my gospel tracts when I do that. They are, how did you do that? Now, I've learned I have to sometimes have two of them, two or three, and I keep my finger on one. I keep this finger on the one as I pull the other out, okay? And when you do two, they get really freaked out. How did you do that? Oh, it's a printer. I don't know. Then when I run out, when I use all the time, I'm out of ink. Sorry. It's an easy way to start a conversation. And people are like, wow, that's amazing. He did magic. Right? No, it's actually just an app that I took a picture of the track and it prints it. And it's whoever designed it for business cards. I use it for tracks. So I could tell you what the app is later. If you're interested, you could look it up. Ray Comfort actually created one just for their tracks, but I use my own tracks that I create. So, but there's a lot of different tracks you can have. But here's the thing with a track. You see that business size, the issue with that is you have really small print, isn't it, on the back? Yeah, I can't read that anymore. But the smaller the track, the easier it is to slip in the pocket, the more it's going to be kept. You give a big track, it's going to be thrown away. The bigger the track, the more likely it's going to be thrown away. Okay? Unless it's something novel. I have million-dollar bills. I walk up to people and go, dude, you look like you're worth a million, you know? You know, things like that. And people are like, oh, that's funny. And hey, it has a really important message on the back. It has a million-dollar question on the back. Do you know what the million-dollar question is? Where we spend eternity, right? Now I'm into a gospel conversation right from the tract. And so you can have funny tracts. You can have serious tracts. But the advantage of tracts is tracts can go anywhere. They can go places you can't go. You know, I had a gospel tract in Spanish that goes to Spanish people. I can't speak Spanish. I somehow passed Spanish class by saying yo no sé for every answer. That's I don't know. That's the only Spanish I know is I don't know in Spanish. The teacher should not have passed me. Shouldn't have. But they also preach the same message every time. Right? They can go to the stores. They can go to, you know, if you library. How many people go to like a McDonald's, a Dunkin' Donuts for coffee? Or coffee shop? I'll just do more Jack. Who goes to coffee shops? Who goes to the library? Who goes to the grocery store? What do you go for? What do you go grocery store for? Food? What do you go to coffee shop for? Yeah, so you know why I go to the coffee shops? See, I go to Dunkin' Donuts so that I can hand out gospel tracts, and sometimes I remember to get coffee. Because I have actually forgotten to get coffee. Because I give out gospel tracts, and the guy started a conversation. I got out of line, so I didn't hold up the line, and then I started walking out with him, and I got in my car, drove to work, and realized I never got my coffee. That's okay, because that's not why I went there anyway. I went there to give out gospel tracts, right? And so I have different tracts for different things, and they're always going to say the same message every time, okay? One of the things, I have some crazy things I've tried and things that work with handing out a gospel tract. I don't know what it is about men, but if you call a man boss, he is more likely to take a gospel tract. And I had a friend of mine say, "That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of." And I said, "No, really, it works." And we were in Washington Square Park, and the gospel tract is out like this. The guy's walking to me. He's already got the hand in proper mode, right? Stop, I'm not taking it. And as he's walking past me, I'm just like, "Did you get one of these, boss?" And literally on the word boss, the guy went. And my friend was like, "I'm calling everyone boss now." Now, not to be left out, guys must have a pride problem. You call them boss. They like that. Now, my buddy Chad Williams, the Navy SEAL, he calls everyone chief. When you're a Navy SEAL, that can work for you. So we got to have something for the women. What works well for women? I don't know why this works, but if I say to a woman, "This is just for you," she's more likely to take it. I don't know why. I'm going to tell the next woman it's just for her too. I don't know what it is about women that if they think they're the only ones that get it, it's for them. They're special. But you know what? I have a friend of mine. You know how he gives out gospel tracts? No, seriously. He mumbles. My friend Mark Spence. We were on the boardwalk. We were tired. We were exhausted. And we're giving out tracts. He and I are giving out the same tracts. I'm going to hand a tract to someone. They're rejecting it. He's just like, "Ugh." And they're taking it. "Mark, what are you doing?" He goes, "I'm just so tired." "What are you trying to say?" "I don't even know." I'm like, "But they're always taking your tracts." You can mumble. I had a friend of mine, he once ran out of gospel tracts. You know what he did? He went into CVS and he got index cards. And he was handing out blank index cards. And people were coming up to him, "Hey, mine's blank." He goes, "Yeah, it was supposed to be, because you have to be pure white. You have to be perfectly clean to get into heaven. You know, if you're not white, you know, if you just even have one speck of sin in that card, it's no longer white. That represents what we'd be with just one lie." So he ran out of tracks, so he just figured he'd give out empty index cards, and people were just coming up thinking they were missing out on something. You ever get that? I told you about the spam callers. What about the spam mail? You know what that is? You know what that is you get in the mailbox? Those pre-posted page envelopes? That's a tract receptacle. That's for you to slip gospel tracts in and mail it back to them at their expense. It's a wonderful thing. I mean, when you send in your bill, you know what? Put a gospel tract in it. Someone's going to open that. You don't even know where it's going to go. You're going to get to heaven one day and someone's going to be like, "You paid a bill and you put a gospel tract in. I read that and got saved." I had a friend of mine. He got saved. He hates littering. And so what he did was he saw a gospel tract on the ground that someone threw away. He picked it up, threw it in his pocket, went night drinking, came home that night, threw everything on his dresser. In the morning, he got up, didn't even know. He's like, "Well, what is this anyway?" Read it and got saved. Okay? So you can leave gospel tracts in lots of places, okay? And so tracts are a great way to start conversations, okay? Because what you can do with a tract is, if you're afraid to have that conversation, it does it for you. We had, on the way out here, we had our flight was delayed, and the airlines gave us some vouchers for the meals. Of course, they sent me the email of the voucher after I was on my last flight. Like, when do I get to use this, right? So my bride and I just said, "Okay, well, we'll grab some lunch to go here in Spokane." And, well, they gave me six $15 vouchers. Okay, so two sandwiches, $45. What in the world? I thought New York was expensive. But I got three more vouchers. What do I do? Well, I saw a couple sitting there, and I walked over. I said, did you guys, because they were just drinking water at that moment. I said, are you guys ordering some food? Yeah. I said, can we buy your meal? I got some extra vouchers. The guy goes, you want the money? I'll give you the money for it. I said, no, we want to bless you. And so then we give them gospel tracts. Of course, they're from Utah, and they say they're Christians.
Yeah.
I restrained myself. My wife must be so proud. Because she knows I was looking for that conversation. I knew exactly what they were. I'm like, I so want to say, are you part of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? Then you're not Christian. Let's talk about that. Yeah, I wanted to, but I refrained. Because I knew our bags were downstairs waiting, and we had to get going. So, but, you know, how do we start one-on-one conversations? There's some things you could do to start one-on-one conversations. One of the first things I look for is tattoos. I love tattoos. Because whoever's putting a tattoo, they're making a permanent statement. I remember I saw a guy in New York. I saw heaven and hell on his arm. And I thought, oh, I'm going to start. I mean, talk about an open door. I said, dude, I like your tattoo, heaven and hell. You know, I often talk about heaven and hell. And just as I'm saying that, I see him turn and I see a different tattoo. And it says Maria. And it had two dates. And they were 1 year apart. And I suddenly said, can you tell me who Maria is? He says, that's my older sister. Now think about that. An older sister who died when she was one. Tells his son about his family. They never got over that. I mean, so much so that he tattooed permanent marker and a sister he never met. She died before he was born. You think we could talk about life being short? Had a great conversation. And it started about something he takes personal. A lot of times people, when they get tattoos, they have meanings for them. So ask them, hey, what's the meaning of that? You could just be asking. It's just a question, right? You know, clothing. Sometimes people wear something that, you know, that you can use to start conversation. Jewelry sometimes. Sometimes, their hair. Like I said with Butch, what do you do for a living that you have hair like that? But what we want to do is swing from the natural to spiritual. Remember Jesus with the woman at the well? What did he do? He starts talking about water. And from the water, he turns to living water. Right? What does Paul do in Acts 17? He goes from a statue of an unknown God and switches from that to the gospel. You can do this. Is one of the hardest things for people to do when sharing the gospel is the swing from the natural to the spiritual. Most Christians feel comfortable once it gets into a spiritual conversation, okay? But it's getting there seems to be hard. So I say this, with practice, you can take any conversation and get it to the gospel, okay? Now, I'm going to say this, if you need some examples, if you go to YouTube and look up our YouTube channel, Striving for Eternity, we have a playlist called the Spiritual Transition Game. I've turned this into a game. And you could play this with friends. We I was out in Indianapolis, we were doing an evangelism training like this, and after we were debriefing after the evangelism, and we sat around the table, and we were having sushi. And so one of the guys goes, Andrew, start a conversation from sushi to the gospel. And we all went around the table. And everybody had a different way of sharing the gospel. But I can do it from, I think, from anything. Because I've been practicing it for like 30 years. So here's what I'm going to ask. Jason, I would like you to give me something. Whatever the first thing in your mind. Anything that you could think of. And I got to take whatever you give me to the gospel.
Digital watches.
What do you got, a thing against analog? What are you? You don't like the old school people? No.
I like analog.
Well, the thing is, digital watches, people will think are more precise. But really what we end up seeing with digital watches, if you think about it, your analog watch does one thing, right? It tells time. Maybe it'll tell date, but that's still a way of telling time. But your digital watches no longer just tell you time. Actually, they do everything but that, right? It tells you who's calling you. It tells you who's texting you. It tells you how your heart's doing. It tells you how your blood oxygen is doing, right? It's telling you all these things about your health, trying to be the answer to everything. And yet people don't rely on it for the one thing that it's actually called, a watch, to tell time. You know, but here's the thing. When you think about it, there's something that we know about analog watches. See, when a digital watch breaks, it's kind of useless, right? But do you know that an analog watch, even though it's broken, it's still right twice a day? Two times a day, an analog watch is always going to be right, where a digital watch is just broken. It's useless. But here's the thing. You know, being right, God bless you, being right twice a day, even though that's better than being wrong all the time, being right twice a day still isn't good enough. Because if we want to know truth, we got to be right 100% of the time, right? So here's the thing. When we think about being right and talking about truth, where do we get truth from? You know, we have to get truth from a source that knows everything, that can't ever be wrong. So there is a source for that. It's the Bible. God says that he's the one that gives us what truth is. He tells us what truth is because it's from his very nature. But you know what the truth of the Bible says is that you and I break God's law, and we can't be perfect. We're like that broken digital clock. We're not even right twice a day. We're just broken. But God made a way of escape from a digital watch. Now, if it seems that I could do that well, it's because I literally do this all the time. Okay? I've just had a lot of practice. Now, granted, I will tell you, at the beginning of that, I had no idea where I was going to go with it. And if you ask me 3 years from now, I'll probably go somewhere totally different. Okay? But there's sometimes I remember some of these things and I go to use them. I remember I was asked to share the gospel from a siren on a fire truck. And I was sitting in New York and I'm talking to this guy and an ambulance went by. My transition was, just like that fire truck has a siren to warn you of a danger to come, that's what this message I'm giving you is, a message of warning. Well, when that ambulance went by, the guy's head just went like this and I lost him. I mean, he lost that conversation. He was there. And I went, you know what? You hear that siren? That's a warning to warn you, just like what I'm telling you. And I got him right back into the conversation. Right? So sometimes that helps. But it's that transition. And the more you practice that, then you could take any conversation and make it a gospel conversation. You no longer have to pray, Lord, give me a gospel opportunity. No, now you make them. Now you can take any conversation and make it a gospel. But what does it take? It takes some practice. Anyone hear the phrase, practice makes perfect? You know it's wrong. I train martial arts. So one of the things we do with guys, especially when they're one of the reasons that with the style of karate that I taught, we have, if any of you do martial arts? Any do karate? Okay, so here's the thing that they teach people to do karate. When you're a lower ranked belt, you're supposed to punch like this and turn your fist. You know why they teach people to do this? That's why I laugh when I saw a commercial with these things where you're supposed to do push-ups and they turn like this and go, yeah, just like with karate when you turn your fist. You know the purpose of turning your fist? To lessen your punch so you don't hurt people when you're not properly trained. And you know what happens when they get to be a black belt? You're teaching them how to punch straight. Now you have to correct what they have now made permanent. Do you know how many black belts struggle after years of going like this to now going like this? Right? So practice doesn't make permanent or perfect, because if you practice wrong, you're not going to do it right. It's not going to be perfect. Practice makes permanent. If you practice the right thing, you'll do the right thing. But if you practice the wrong, that's what you're training yourself for. And so what you do is you want to practice these things and practice them right. So when you have that opportunity, you can go, I can take any conversation and turn it to the gospel. Now the question is not whether it's an opportunity for you to, it's are you going to do it? Oops, sorry. So with that, what we want to do is this. I want us to break up into teams, like two or three people, to be able to practice the good person test, right? So what I want you, I'm going to tell you why. How many people are uncomfortable doing role play? I know I am. Good. Okay, so I'm not alone. Here's why we do this. The role play is really important because guess what? The person you're paired up with isn't going to reject you and call you names and make you feel bad. So it's a safe environment to practice. But it's really important because, you know, the more you hear yourself saying it, the easier it gets when you're on the street. When you get used to sharing the gospel, I mean, I had a guy, Art Goodman, right? What? How do I open with the gospel? What's the line I use? Are you a good person? You know what he said? He goes, I always like to use my first initial. That way I'm a good man. Without even thinking, because I've done it so often, it was like second nature. All of a sudden I went, oh, so you consider yourself to be a good person. I was in a work environment. That's not where I should have been sharing the gospel, right, during work hours. It just came out because it became so natural to me. When he said, I like to say I'm a good man, I went, oh, so you consider yourself to be a good person, and boom, now we're in a gospel. I'm like, well, okay, I opened that door, so, you know, I'll work later tonight. But that's the thing, that when we practice with each other, and when we do this, don't try to be cruel to the person. I mean, like, be like the way, so if you're sitting there saying, have you ever told a lie, you know, we don't want to be hard on the person that's doing the evangelism, okay? But the goal of this is to help yourself not only hear the gospel being presented by the other person, but then you saying it. You know, Ray Comfort had, he and Todd Friel started a radio show many years ago called Way of the Master Radio. I don't know if any of you used to listen to it. One of the things they would do is they'd go on the streets, and Ray would be in the studio, and they'd have someone that would go on the streets and get someone on the phone on the radio, and then Ray would share the gospel with them. Okay? What people didn't realize is that the most effective thing that got people to share the gospel was hearing Ray having the conversations over and over and over. You see, you could watch the videos Ray does, and those videos are clipped. You're not seeing the full video. Now, Ray, by the way, if you want, he does have a new channel. I forgot the name of it. But if you guys want to find the channel, I could text Ray and I'll get it for you, because I don't remember it, but he could tell me. But it's his full conversations. And those are helpful, because what happens is, in the full conversations, you're not hearing him just do the good person test, which is what the videos at Living Waters are. You hear the full conversation, and people started to realize, hey, wait, I can answer. And you start realizing everybody's asking the same questions, okay? So it becomes really helpful. So the reason we do the role-playing is because the more you practice this, it's just, the reality is, the easier it's going to be for you to make it part of your repertoire, just how you speak with folks, all right? And so what I want to do is, if you either groups of two or three, and just ask, you know, you're going to ask, you want to just practice asking, do you consider yourself to be a good person? Then you go through any of the Ten Commandments that you want. Have you ever lied? What would that make you? Have you ever coveted? What would that make you? You know, have you ever used God's name in vain? What would that make you? Blasphemer, right? So just going through those, and then say, okay, by that standard, would you be innocent or guilty? Guilty, okay. Would you deserve heaven or hell? Hell, does that concern you? Okay. I know that in role play, I hate doing role play. Okay, I'm just telling you. But I also know the value of it. The value of it is, it's a safe environment for us to be able to talk. And you can sit there and say, okay, pretend you're an atheist, pretend you're a, you know, someone who's a Muslim. If you know, like, you can talk what the person's going to be. Maybe they're going to be a false convert. You know, but it's the practice helps us. Okay, so we're gonna. What do you want to do? Like half an hour, 45 minutes?
Yeah, half
an hour. I know you had an hour, but
8:15.
Okay.
Yeah, and then
we'll wrap up with questions. Okay.
I do,